as well. In the American League, the White Sox lost to Cleveland 10-2. Tonight, the Brewers are off. Cubs host the Pirates again down at Wrigley. The White Sox are off as well. The regular season ends on Sunday. NFL Thursday Night Football, Minnesota takes on the LA Rams. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Thursday, September 27th. Sunny for the morning, partly sunny for the afternoon. Today's high, 68. Here are the numbers now. Wind from the west-southwest at 6. Sunshine with 48 degrees Racine, 47 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTE also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Once again, I have had the really intriguing experience of reading and loving a book actually designed for young readers. And I'm not sure what it says about me as a reader, but time and time again, I find myself thoroughly engrossed when books of this ilk are really, really well written. And that is certainly the case with a new book, which is called Nowhere Boy. And maybe it should come as no surprise because its author is certainly skilled in the art and science of writing well for young readers. Catherine Marsh, an award-winning author. Her previous books include The Doors by the Staircase, Jep Who Defied the Stars, The Twilight Prisoner, The Night Tourist. This latest book called Nowhere Boy is very much steeped in the current refugee crisis that so much of the world has been experiencing. And what is especially intriguing about this book is that it involves really kind of parallel stories that ultimately intertwine of two relatively young boys who find themselves displaced from all that they have known and loved, displaced very much against their wishes under very, very different circumstances, however. And we will talk with Catherine Marsh about all that inspired her in the writing of this really marvelous book. Again, it is called Nowhere Boy, and the book is published by Roaring Brook Press. Catherine Marsh, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg, for having me.
I'm really excited to speak with you. Could you say a word about the kind of special challenge and pleasure of writing this kind of book, doing this kind of work, that is, writing with younger readers in mind? I mean, these aren't children's books. I think we're talking about books for slightly older young people. But what do you think about as you do this kind of writing? And maybe along the way, explain also what drew you to this particular field.
Absolutely. Well, I think those two questions are really interrelated in this case. This was a very unique book for me in that it came out of a personal experience that my family and I had in that in 2015, in that summer, my husband got a job in Brussels, Belgium. And we moved our entire family there, including our two school-age children. And we ended up enrolling them in the local French-Belgian school, and they did not know a word of French when we did this, so it was really an immersion for them. And we arrived there in the summer of 2015 at the height of the refugee crisis in Europe. There were over 1 million refugees that were coming into Europe that year, and at the same time, over the course of that year, there were also the terror attacks in Paris, the lockdown of Brussels, which we experienced, and then the following spring, the terror attacks in Brussels themselves. So there was really so much going on that year, and I felt very compelled to write this book as a way, in some ways, to explain what was going on to my children and to help them process what they were seeing and living abroad in Belgium.
Hmm. What about the matter of writing with young readers in mind? What gives you sort of special pleasure in doing that, or in what ways do you feel like your gifts align with that particular task?
Absolutely. Well, I'm a writer for children. I'm also a parent, and I have a background as a political journalist. So this is all in my wheelhouse to kind of try to write about current events and world affairs. For children was very attractive to me. But I also think there's so much going on in the world right now that, you know, begs explanation. And I think children are very much aware of a lot of a lot of the news and a lot of the attitudes and a lot of, this is a very difficult time, I think, not just in America, but around the world with the rise of the far right and with a lot of, anger and fear. And I felt it was very important for children to be able to explore these issues in a way that was appropriate for them. And the way that I do that is by, writing a story that has a very compelling narrative that involves children. But I also think it's very important when you deal with difficult issues to give children a way not to feel helpless and hopeless, but to actually work into the story some ideas about what they can do to make their world better. Because I think even as adults, a lot of us feel right now a little bit confused and helpless, and I think children pick up on that. So I really wanted to write a story that gave children almost a roadmap for things that they could do to make the world better around them, even when it felt like it was falling apart.
Hmm. That maybe helps me understand why I also loved reading your book so much, even though I'm far from a young person now. But I think you're absolutely right. It is very easy, in fact, all but inescapable probably, for the typical adult to feel utterly overwhelmed by a lot of the problems that confront us right now. And I'd not stop to think about how maybe one element in a really good young person's book like this is that element of hope and that sense of agency that we're always anxious for young people to claim for themselves.
Exactly. And I think that feeling of powerlessness that a lot of us feel as adults is something that children feel by nature of being small and being somewhat more powerless than adults just in their everyday lives. So I really felt that there is a way to explore this issue and to write about how you can have a sense of agency, when you feel that you're stuck. And both these boys in this book do feel very much stuck and displaced.
Hmm. We're speaking with Catherine Marsh about her new book called Nowhere Boy. Ahead of us talking about a few elements in the book itself, I'd like to circle back to your own family's real life experience in Belgium, because as you said, that is very much why this book ultimately sprang from you, and as vividly as it does. You say that it was your husband's work that took you all the way to Belgium. Was this kind of dramatic displacement anything that your family had already experienced before? There are some people who are in lines of work in which this almost becomes a very exotic sort of norm to be moving to other countries at various points in the family's collective life. But was this something relatively unprecedented for your family and especially for your children?
It really was. Yes, it really was. I mean, we had lived in Washington, D.C. My husband is a journalist, and he had been covering defense and the Pentagon for many, many years and had traveled for his work, but we had always stayed stationary in D.C. So this was our first international posting. And it really did open our eyes, I think, in a lot of ways to the experience. And what was interesting from my perspective is I have three grandparents who were immigrants. And one of my grandparents, my grandmother, who I grew up with, who came to the country in 1928, actually had to come to the U.S. through Mexico because of the 1924 Immigration Act that excluded immigrants from Eastern Europe and saw them as undesirables. So it was very hard for Eastern Europeans to get into the country at that point. So she had to come from, she was originally from Ukraine and then went through Mexico into the U.S. And I grew up with her, and she never learned English properly. And this gave me a whole new respect for the experience that she went through. And we were doing it, of course, under very different circumstances with a lot more resources and support and legal status and all of that. But it really made me think about the experience of all the people who are displaced around the world. And there is so much global migration right now.
So the American boy, who is one of the principal characters in your book, Max, 13 or 14 years old, I suspect that at least a large part of how he is shaped in this book springs from the experience of your own son in Belgium and his own experience of displacement. Let's talk first about that. I mean, your son and his sense of displacement. Just how difficult was it for you and for him and for you as a family?
It was hard in the beginning. He was younger than Max. He was 7 years old when we moved to Brussels, but he went into second grade without speaking any French, really, and there were very few people at the school we went to who spoke English. So it was a very stressful experience for him, and there was a lot of cultural readjustment. And we're now having that as we moved back to the U.S. this summer, and we're now having that in reverse. But there was a lot to get used to in terms of, you know, the different cultural expectations. For example, the children at the school where he went, and this is true really in Belgium across the board, they use fountain pens. So instead of having your whiteboards and your computers, it was a kind of more old-fashioned setup where the children had to learn to write a very elegant cursive. And that's something that I worked into the book as well.
I was just going to say, I remember reading that about Max struggling with the fountain pen and nothing coming out. And it was just one more reason to be frustrated with this unwanted new life for him in Belgium. So
yes. Exactly. And Max is a character who has not, he's a very, he's in a family of achievers, and he himself is a bit of an underachiever. And he's always sort of struggled to find a place in his family and in this very sort of achievement-based culture that he's been in Washington, D.C. And one of the things I wanted to explore, because the book isn't just about exploring Belgium, it's about exploring America. And I think when you leave your country, you have such an interesting vantage point into, you know, what your own country is all about. And one of the things that I felt somewhat critical of when I left the U.S. was how achievement-focused, particularly early education, was in this country, and how, you know, kids are not always getting the support that they need just to grow socially and to become independent. And, you know, I felt I wanted to write about that a little bit as well through the character of Max, because he really, over the course of this book, he finds a sense of self, and that sense of self isn't developed necessarily by becoming the best student or the best at anything, but it's by becoming a kinder, more tolerant person who helps someone else.
Right. I think one of the things you do really well with the character of Max is that he is, in the beginning certainly, he is a very unhappy boy, and yet we don't grow tired of him, and we feel for him. But as I read the first passages in the book about him, it just occurred to me that it would be the easiest thing in the world to for an author to, in a sense, maybe kind of overwrite such a character or craft him in such a way that we just don't like him, that we find him kind of pitiful, or I don't know. I mean, I think it's really easy to, in a sense, set the wrong tone, or create a character with whom we don't have kind of the right feelings that you want us to have. And I feel like with Max, you paint him very vividly. You don't sort of smooth the rough edges of him or of his experience, and yet it's painted in such a way that we really feel for him. We realize that if we were that 13 or 14-year-old displaced similarly from all that we had known and loved, we would be just like Max.
Thank you. That's a real compliment. I mean, I wanted to take the character of Max, and also because there's so many great books for, you know, of refugee lit right now for kids, but there are not as many about children, American children abroad. And I felt it was important to have a character who was outside of his comfort zone, who is an American, because there are a lot of kids who might not see themselves in an outsider, but through the character of Max could see themselves as an outsider and imagine themselves in a place where they themselves felt discombobulated and, you know, they didn't understand what was going on. And language is a big part of this book, and both Ahmed and Max, you know, struggle with language and have to overcome it as a barrier. And I think in such a monolingual society as ours, we sometimes forget, you know, the difficulty of that for people.
Right. And, of course, one of the realities that especially Max in the beginning of the book faces is not just how difficult it is to function, for instance, in a schoolroom where nearly every word by everyone in that room is spoken in French, a language he doesn't know. But at one point he is thinking aloud to himself, how was he supposed to make friends when he couldn't even speak to them? I mean, on the most fundamental sort of level, that would be just the most frightening of prospects for anybody. I mean, even for an adult, let alone for a 13 or 14 year old.
Absolutely. I mean, I felt terrible for my children when they spent 8 hours a day in the beginning, those first few months, and they would come home and be absolutely drained. And, you know, I think their young brains were able to do it, but it was very, very exhausting. And some of the details I included in the book were true to life. There were some boys, I remember one of the first few days, who came up to my son and said, "Do you speak English?" And he was so excited to hear English until he realized that was the only thing they could say. so it definitely, you know, I think it's a very difficult experience, but one that teaches you a lot about yourself and also, you know, I think teaches children resilience.
Right, absolutely. It's interesting, too. This reminds me of something I haven't thought of in a long time. I had a former voice student of mine at one point spent a summer in Costa Rica, and this was a situation in which he actually knew Spanish pretty darn well, but not fully fluent. And the thing that Nick missed the most in that time in Costa Rica, and it was just a summer, was just how he just couldn't have the kind of deep conversations that he typically loved to have. That was like one of the best things in life, was to have a deep philosophical conversation or a debate or, you know, really intense discussion about something. And when your acquaintance with the language is only at the level of, you know, kind of ordering a hamburger or how are you, I mean, it puts all of that out of reach. And not that a character like Max necessarily is about that sort of thing, but even 14-year-old boys like to really talk about, I mean, the movies they love or what they're scared about. And and for him not to be able to have even those kind of basic conversations, even if he would start to have the most rudimentary acquaintance with French, I mean, it still isn't the same as being surrounded with people with whom you can really talk.
It's very isolating. I think that's absolutely true. But here's the thing that I think can be positive about it, is that it forces you to kind of to get down to fundamentals and find things that are commonalities between you and another person on a very basic level. And this was true for me as an adult as well, because my French is terrible. My children would vouch for that. but, you know, I would have to learn to adapt my conversations, you know, to a simple level, but at the same time to try to convey warmth and interest and basic humanity. And so I think that exercise actually can be very good for children. And, you know, when you learn also another language, you learn another way of thinking about life. And so, but it is a struggle, and it's very difficult. And both these characters have to do this through the course of the book.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you about another thing that I wondered might spring out of your own real life experience. At one point, Max is really bridling under the notion that his parents are sharing with him about how all of this is an adventure that he should be embracing, and he does not begin to think of any of this as an adventure. I mean, that's just, for as far as he's concerned, kind of a mockery of what the word really means. And I was just curious, as you were dealing with your children and trying to get them to warm up to this idea, do you remember trying to describe it or frame it as an adventure?
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And I think parents do this all the time when they have to do a difficult transition. You're moving somewhere, even in the country, and you say, well, this is going to be fun, this is going to be an adventure, and you're trying to get them really psyched up for it. But kids are so, you know, emotionally intuitive, and they think about it in their own way. And you know, Max is at the age also where he's starting to see his parents as flawed, which I think happens when you get to be around 12, 13 years old. You really see the ways in which your parents, you know, are human. And you know, he finds this whole thing to be, you know, almost a put-on for him, that this is going to be an adventure. But, of course, it does turn into one, just not in the way he expects.
Absolutely. Nor his parents, for sure.
No, not at all.
And it's also really interesting at some point, again, this is early in the book, where there is this conversation going on, I think, between Max and his mother. And finally, Max's mother just has to say, it's not a choice. I mean, those are the words.
Yep.
It's not a choice. And, of course, that's also part of what this reality is, and it's maybe part of what young Max has to learn and what your own children have to learn, is that life is not full of limitless choices, and that sometimes we find ourselves in a situation that is not of our choosing, but it is not a choice to exit. It simply is what it is. And
It's non-negotiable, and that was true in our case. But we also really did feel that there's going to be a lot of enrichment in this experience for our children. But you have to really keep believing that the first 6 months that you do something like this, because it is very difficult and very stressful for everyone in the family.
Mm. I also liked that as you sketch for us the scene of Max at his first beginning in school, that you paint, I think, a very vivid and realistic picture of what the other children are like. Not really kind, but not exactly unkind, and nobody really terrible to him. You know, mostly just sort of wary and kind of keeping a distance and uncertain and so on. But, you know, that can feel very different for Max, for instance, or your own son. I just thought that was really interesting, because, again, I think often for an author, the temptation is to go a little too far and paint a picture of a classroom full of monsters and then this beleaguered, heroic little figure in the middle of it, you know, trying to carry on. And that isn't really the way life typically plays out. And I trust that your own son's experience was roughly akin to what Max experienced in the classroom.
Yes, I mean, it was definitely fictionalized. So even though my son's experience formed a basis for the book, and a lot of these wonderful details, like the fountain pens, came out of just watching him go through the experience, I definitely, you know, extrapolated and fictionalized. But I did get a sense of kind of what the school community was like in Belgium and Brussels. And it has such an interesting, Brussels is such it's, you know, the capital of the European Union. There are a lot of expats from other countries in Europe. There's a sizable Muslim population. It's a very diverse place, and I wanted to sort of give people a sense of what Brussels today is like, and what it was like particularly during that year when a lot of really frightening things were going on, including the lockdown and terror attacks.
I also want to be sure to ask you, what was it like for you to live there, and to what extent, as someone, you've said already, your French is terrible. I would just have to take your word for it. But I mean, what was it like for you on a very personal level? And to what extent was that a help for you in helping your children through their own experience? And also, what kind of a help was it for you in crafting the story of Max and Ahmed, for that matter? I mean, in terms of your own experience in Belgium.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because when we moved over there, I had just I had a book coming out that winter, and I figured I'm going to take a little break, and I'm going to just, you know, spend 6 months, like, getting everyone comfortable in this new environment, and then I'm going to go sit in a cafe and live my little European dream and put on my beret. And, and it was nothing like that. I mean, partly because of all these big news events going on that year. But, you know, I expected it to be a place that would be a lot quieter than Washington, D.C., even though it does have this huge bureaucratic operation going on. I was aware when we moved there that there was terrorism in Europe. My husband was going to cover European security, so this was not a surprise to us. But it, I also didn't expect it to hit so close to home. And so to have experiences, for example, like our children's school was closed during the lockdown in November, and that's when, after the Paris attacks, the masterminds of that attack, it turned out, were Belgians, and they, you know, were in Brussels, and the police locked down the whole city to try to find them, and we were told, you know, not to go out into public places, and it was really an incredible experience. And I was in New York for 9/11, so this was not my, you know, my first experience with terrorism, but it was really not at all what I had imagined going through when we moved there. And we had to revisit as a family some of these things that we had talked about when we left the U.S. For example, you know, I had talked to my children because, you know, the whole Newtown massacre was very much on my mind about school shootings and what to do if there is an active shooter. And I felt that was an important discussion to have. And I thought I wouldn't have to have that discussion in Belgium. And lo and behold, I ended up having another, you know, variation of that discussion about, you know, terrorism and about what to do if there's a terror attack. So all of that, I mean, it brought to home the you know, the idea that you can't escape. There's nowhere to go. I mean, the whole world has a lot of, you know, trouble right now. But also it just made, you know, it made me think a lot about what my children were growing up with and how to explain this to them and how not to get completely overwhelmed by fear, because I think fear really short circuits empathy. And I wanted them to continue to be open and empathetic.
Wow. Very good. And you wanted to be as well.
I did, absolutely.
Right.
And, you know, it was really grappling with, you know, every parent there, I think, was grappling with fear. There was a point where they were worried terrorists could attack schools. And, you know, it definitely made you very wary. But at the same time, you also wanted to be very careful about not confusing feelings and facts. Because, you know, there are a lot of refugees coming in, and, you know, the vast majority of those refugees were escaping war. They were not terrorists. And so, you know, it took a lot of, I would say, a lot of thoughtfulness and emotional discipline to separate fear and facts.
Right.
And that was something I wanted my children to learn to do.
Towards that end, of course, Brussels, I believe, while you lived there, also suffered then a terrorist attack of its own.
That's right, in March of 2016.
And I'm just wondering, what was that like for you? I mean, to be, to experience something that in some ways was terribly familiar, and yet in a very still unfamiliar place, even though it's where you lived. And I even think about something as basic as, how were you able to get your information? I mean, what was it like to watch the news in Brussels? And I mean, I should think there are a lot of ways in which it had to feel completely different because of where you were.
Absolutely. I mean, I will say that Brussels is, Belgium itself has three official languages, German, French, and Dutch, and a lot of people do speak English, and there is a huge English-speaking expat community, and they're not all even from Anglo countries, but from Eastern Europe and other places who speak English. So there was a great community of people who shared information, and some of those people were bi and trilingual. And were able to kind of disseminate information. So I didn't feel as much of a loss about getting information as I did just about not knowing what the kind of necessarily the mores were for how the police would act and how, you know, what, you know, when I was in New York during 9/11, I'm a New Yorker, and I, you know, I knew the NYPD and I knew the fire department. I know sort of that culture a little bit more, and so it was more familiar to me, and you don't know what the rules and the laws and the way that people are going to act is going to be in a different society. So that is a little bit unsettling, definitely. And on the day of the terror attack itself, my children were in school, and I ended up, when we heard that the airport was bombed and then a metro station, a metro was bombed, which was very close to where my husband worked, I just went to the school, which is around the corner, luckily, from our house, and I picked the kids up because I didn't know what was going to happen next. And, you know, by that point, because it was already March of that year, they knew because of the lockdown, because of Paris, because of things like that, they knew what a terrorist attack was. And
that is your children. Your children knew.
These are my children. My children who were, you know, at that point, 8 and 5. And they were able to understand what was going on, and they understood why I picked them up. But it was, you know, it was a situation that I certainly hadn't expected to experience when we moved there that previous summer.
Wow, nothing like the idyllic scenes of sitting quietly in cafes day after day.
Right.
Wow.
Right, right. But Europe has a lot of, you know, there's a lot of trouble going on there. And, you know, that was certainly something we were aware of. We were there through the Brexit. We were there, you know, seeing a lot of the rise of the far right parties. You know, so the fact that you can find peace anywhere on this planet right now is certainly a bit of a fiction itself, right? Mm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with award-winning, best-selling author Catherine Marsh about her latest book, which is titled Nowhere Boy. The book, for the most part, is set in the nation of Belgium, in the city of Brussels. And it springs very much out of the real-life experience of Catherine Marsh and her family when they lived for a time in Brussels, Belgium, and her own two children experienced a difficult sense of displacement, as does the young American boy who is one of the main characters in this book, Max, who at one point characterizes the school that he is attending in Brussels as the school of misery, although eventually begins to do a little bit better. The other main character, whom we've only briefly mentioned thus far, mm-hmm. is a 14-year-old boy by the name of Ahmed, and he has experienced in his own life a very different kind of displacement from that experienced by Max. Even more wrenching and far more tragic. But there are many things that these two boys share in common, as they eventually discover when their paths cross and they ultimately become friends. Describe to our listeners the situation of Ahmed and what he has experienced already as your book opens.
Absolutely. So Ahmed is he arrives in Belgium as an unaccompanied minor. And that means a child who's traveled the refugee route essentially alone, who's been orphaned. And one of the things that really inspired me to write this character was the fact that in 2015, during that year, about 2,600 unaccompanied minors ended up in Belgium. And of that 2,600, all of them were under 14 years old, which is an incredible fact to me that children that young were traveling alone, and
wow.
They're such a vulnerable population. And so Ahmed comes from the city of Aleppo in Syria, and he loses his family, most of his family, in a bombing there, but he and his father managed to flee the country. And then he loses his father on the boat trip from Turkey to Greece. And Ahmed ends up in Belgium. It's not the country that he and his father had originally intended to seek asylum in. And he does not want to register there. And he knows if he registers there that he cannot go on to other countries. This is part of the Dublin Act, which the EU put into effect, which meant that the place you register, the country you registered in is the country that you should remain in. And Ahmed does not want to remain in Belgium, but at the same time, he is really lost and frightened and alone, and his path and Max's does cross. And Ahmed is also a boy who really liked school before. He comes from an academic family. His father's a teacher and has been out of school for several years. And this is another issue that I really wanted to highlight, because so many children, refugee children, have interrupted educations, and it's really hard to make that up. And so I wanted to write about a boy, one boy who hated school, is at the School of Misery, as you call it, as you mentioned it's called, and another boy who really finds, you know, school to be a constant that he misses and that's, you know, inaccessible to him.
Right. I think that is so important and also kind of a heartbreaking thing to contemplate. I think when we see pictures of young children who are refugees, displaced from their homeland for one reason or another, I mean, I think we tend to go to a sort of a shallow place in our sympathy for them. I mean, where we maybe wish they had nicer clothes, or we wish they could play with toys or sleep on a nicer bed. And I think most of us never give a thought to the fact that they are also missing out on just the most kind of standard education, sitting in a classroom with schoolmates and experiencing the immeasurable riches that come with education. And for so many refugee children, this is something that they are almost completely deprived of. And it's a cost we just never stop to count.
Absolutely. And I also wanted to make the point, because the refugee population is so diverse, and the countries that people come from have such different histories and such different socioeconomic profiles. But in Aleppo, you know, there were a lot of middle class, very educated people. And, you know, Ahmed is somebody who grew up expecting to continue through the school system, and who that was cut off from him. And there's a security in that now he is lacking. And I really wanted to highlight that, and highlight also the diversity of refugee experience, because it is so different. I think people lump all refugees together, you know, and you know, the difference from being from Afghanistan and Syria is quite huge. So I wanted to kind of try to paint a picture for children of that, the different populations as well.
Absolutely. I think one of the moments that really put a lump in my throat was when you have Ahmed thinking about the dreams that he and his father had about where they might ultimately end up and the kind of life that they might experience together. If you don't mind me reading a paragraph from your book, Ahmed remembered the life he had imagined with Baba in England, going to school in a language he could at least partially understand, playing on a football club team, eating fish and chips while watching David De Gea's brilliant goalkeeping for Manchester United. Maybe even though Baba was gone, fate was telling him not to give up on England. From gossip at the camp, he knew that the best chance of getting there was through the city of Calais on the northern coast of France. There was another large camp there called the Jungle, where refugees waited for the chance to travel through a train and car tunnel under the sea to England. I think most of us, when we think about refugees, and of course there are plenty of refugees who probably don't have dreams anything like that, but there are those refugees who have some understanding of other parts of the world. And to think about a refugee like Ahmed dreaming of life with his father in a place like England, and all of these delights and joys that they hoped might someday be theirs. That was just heartbreaking to read that passage and to think about the dashed hopes and dreams of someone like Ahmed.
Yes, and I really felt like for children across the world, soccer or football, as Ahmed and so many kids call it, is really something that unites the world. And that's sort of a common theme through the book, that this is something in which, you know, my own son got very fascinated with European soccer and World Cup soccer. And it was amazing how much it taught him about different countries and different, you know, languages and things like that. And I think it's really an incredible force of unification in the world. So that was something that I knew Ahmed would love, and love David De Gea the same way my son does.
I also love the way in which Ahmed did not want to live in Belgium when it appears that that's where he's headed. You write, he barely knew anything about this little country wedged in between France and the Netherlands like a pebble in a shoe. and probably there's plenty of children all around the world and plenty of Americans for that matter who scarcely have any notion whatsoever of where Belgium is or what is there or how important that small little nation is. But that's one of many reasons why Ahmed does not want to be there. You also tell us about Ahmed desperately not wanting to have life in some of these huge centers, and he's also very fearful of his own passport. I mean, there are these kind of logistical worries that also weigh very heavily on his young shoulders.
That's right, you know, and I wanted to try to, what I did for Ahmed's story, because obviously with Max I had a lot of personal material that I could use and felt a degree of confidence about. But obviously, with Ahmed's story, I needed to really find out a lot about, I went back to my journalism background, and I ended up interviewing a lot of refugees from Aleppo. I interviewed an unaccompanied minor who actually told me very much what you were saying about he ended up in Belgium, and he had no idea, he hadn't expected to end up in Belgium. He wasn't sure what he thought of Belgium when he got there. It wasn't kind of the place he imagined being. And so, you know, I was able to take a lot of that from talking to people. I talked to people who worked in these refugee centers for unaccompanied minors, and I got a sense of kind of what the experience was like for the kids there. And there are a lot of fantastic people that work with refugees in Europe, and a lot of that is done also as volunteer work, which is, you know, always impresses me, because in 2015, there are so many refugees coming in that the government couldn't process them fast enough, and a lot of people ended up sleeping outside in this park in the center of Brussels. And it was such a stark contrast between these office buildings and all of these people in tents in this tent city in the middle of the park next to them. And so I really wanted to, you know, to try to research this to get a strong sense of what this experience was like, of talking to people who made this journey in 2015 and would have had some of these impressions that Ahmed has.
Right. It's also an interesting point that one problem Ahmed faces is his age. He is 14 years old, and yet he apparently looks a little older than 14, and all that he has experienced probably in a sense is aged him or made him seem older than he is. And that, in a sense, opens up a host of other potential problems for him.
That's right. That's right. And one of the things that just one of the details that, you know, I was told and heard about was how there were children who were kind of on the edge of this. They couldn't tell exactly how old they were. And because of lack of documents, in some cases, the children didn't know their birth dates. But they basically would do these dental exams to try to estimate age through dental exams. And, you know, the thought of going through that as a child just seemed terrifying to me. I mean, nobody likes dental exams anyway, but to have somebody then determine your fate through that, about whether you could stay in a shelter for minors or whether you had to be with adults. And, you know, you have to remember that these are very vulnerable children. They're alone. And a lot of the children who traveled by themselves, the unaccompanied minors, were really victimized by traffickers and were really in a vulnerable position.
Really gets us thinking about that. And, of course, the fact that we might look at a photo of a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old refugee and feel a great deal of sympathy. But when we look into the face of someone who is 13 or 14 or 15, we might feel a different kind of sympathy mixed with maybe a little bit of wariness about...
That's right. And in some cases, fear, because you have to remember that with the terror attacks going on, young men who look like they were from Middle Eastern origin were really looked at with a lot of suspicion by many people. So it was fascinating when I was able to, you know, interview with a lot of people and who were young Syrian men and who felt that, you know, during the terror attacks, it was scary for them, not only because they were afraid of terrorists, but because they were afraid of people thinking they were terrorists.
Mm. Well, ultimately, Ahmed makes some choices about what he is going to do and, in a sense, slips underground and ultimately crosses paths with Max and a couple other important characters in the book. Just say a word about how important this element to the story is in terms of the journey that Ahmed chooses for himself and why he chooses it.
Yes. So there is the last third of the book involves a journey that is very counterintuitive for Ahmed to make, which is basically a journey east. He and Max have been helped in this by a group of children. And I've always loved stories in which very different types of children kind of unite to make a, to change the world and find each other. So that's something that I really wanted to, include in the book. And Ahmed takes this huge risk because there's a chance that he could be reunited with someone he loves.
Well, it takes us into some really extraordinary places, and the adventure becomes more and more interesting as it unfolds. And I appreciate so much the great care with which you have crafted this this amazing story. Could you just finish by giving us just a quick word on what life is like for you and your family and your children in particular, as you are now, I believe, back in the United States, no longer in Belgium? And what do your children think about their experiences there?
Absolutely. I mean, there's been a reverse culture shock in some way. We have to get used to, the moment. I mean, leaving America in 2015 and coming back in 2018 is a pretty amazing experience because of all the things that have changed in this country. But I think that one of the things that drove me to come back, there are many things that drove me to come back, including family and friends, and seeing from abroad all the things I love about America. Its imaginativeness, its ingenuity, the friendliness of people here. But one of the things that really made me want to come back was I felt like this narrative really was actually very relevant to the country now. Because when I started writing it in 2015, we didn't have a family separation policy in this country. I mean, I just read today that they're going to cap the number of refugees at a record low of 30,000. This is the lowest number since 1980. I couldn't have imagined all of that back in 2015. But these conversations that I explore in the book about tolerance, about openness, about dealing with real questions of how to integrate people, all of that has become incredibly relevant today. So I'm glad to be back to talk about it and to be part of that conversation.
The book again is called Nowhere Boy, and the book is published by Roaring Brook Press, and the author, Catherine Marsh. Catherine Marsh, I so enjoyed your book and so enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you. Thank you for writing this book. I know that many people will read it and enjoy it as I did, and very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will be previewing the next American Experience documentary called The Circus, a fascinating look at the history of the circus here in the United States. Also tomorrow, a conversation with Kenosha native Tom Vigneri, one of Carthage's most honored musical alums. He is back at Carthage this weekend for the homecoming festivities that honor Dr. Richard Tsierdsma. Tom Vigneri has been commissioned to compose a special piece for the occasion. We will talk with him tomorrow. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. We will be joining Wisconsin Public Radio right at the top of the hour for what I believe will be coverage via NPR of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings on Capitol Hill. Our weather forecast for sunny skies this morning, a few clouds this afternoon, a high of 68 degrees, cloudy overnight with a 30% chance of rain, low down to 48 degrees, cloudy and cool tomorrow, high of 58, a partly sunny day on Saturday, high of 59 degrees, a 50% chance of rain in our forecast for Sunday, warming up into the low 60s, into the low 70s for a high on Monday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Chenier.